Today's Teisho will be on case 20 in the Haikigan Roku, the P.E.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 20 is entitled Ruge Est Suibi and Rinzai. Engo's Introduction. Range upon range of mountain peaks, rock faces and cliffs all deliver their profound sermons. If you stop to think, however, you will be bewildered. Let a man of great strength appear. Overturn the great sea. Kick over Mount Sumeru. Shout and disperse the white clouds. Break up the empty sky. And with each key and every kyo, shut the mouths of all others. Such a person will be truly incomparable. Has ever a person been so wonderful? See the following. Main subject. Ryuge asked Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? Suibi said, pass me the chin rest. Ruge passed the chin rest to Suibi, who took it and hit Ruge. Ruge said, you can strike me. If you strike me, I will let you. But after all, there is still no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming from the west. Ruge asked Rinzai too, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? Rinzai said, pass me the cushion. Ruge passed the cushion to Rinzai, who took it and hit Ruge with it. Ruge said, if you strike me, I will let you. But after all, there is no meaning to Bodhidharma's coming from the west. Secho's verse, Dragon Mountain, the dragon has no eye. Still waters don't impart the ancient way. If the board and cushion don't benefit you, hand them over to me. I have not yet exhausted this, hence another verse. Even if they are given to me, it's useless. Not for me to sit like the ancestor, beautiful, the evening clouds, endless, the distant hills, blue upon blue, peak upon peak. So this is the final, the fifth and final day of our January 2019 Sesshin. And everybody has been practicing so deeply. You know, it's wonderful to sit with people who are so capable of wholehearted practice. And this morning was no exception. It's really wonderful. So thank you so much. Many people have made, let me come at this a different way. In Indian tradition, or in Indian Buddhist tradition, there were a number of ancestors who followed the Buddha. So, for example, Mahakashapa, and then there's a whole series of these. And one of these ancestors was a meditation master named Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma left India and went to China. And he brought the Chan school, the Zen school of meditation from India to China. He's often depicted as riding across the China Sea on a reed, like magically riding a reed, like a cattail, you know, something like a cattail. He's riding a cattail across the sea, and or rather the Indian Ocean. Pardon me, my geography. And arriving in China, and then, you know, basically he went to see Emperor Wu of Liang, as we know from other koans. And Bodhidharma brought Zen to China. You know, there's a wonderful book called Tracking Bodhidharma, by, I believe it's by Andy Ferguson. And I highly recommend it because Andy Ferguson is a private scholar. He doesn't work at a university. But he knows everything about Zen history. And he actually retraced the path of Bodhidharma, pretty much where Bodhidharma arrived in China, and how he made his way from the port cities, Fort City, several of them actually, inland, and eventually did meet Emperor Wu of Liang, who's a real person, and how he did go up into the mountains. And he really talks about all these details. You know, he takes you through this town, and it's like, this is where Bodhidharma, you know, did this, and this is where Bodhidharma did that. And he's got a lot of evidence to support his claims. So even though some people think Bodhidharma is a mythical figure, there probably was a Bodhidharma. And there's a lot of records of people at the time, bureaucrats and so on, registering his arrival. So Bodhidharma brought Chan or Jhana to China, and he met the emperor for an interview because he was a famous meditation master. And when he tried to explain Zen to the emperor did not understand at all. So the emperor said, you know, basically, you studied the sutras, and you know, basically, Bodhidharma said, no, we do read the sutras, but they're really not that important. And then the emperor said, well, you know, basically, are you interested in acquiring merit through good deeds? No, that's really not our thing. And then he said, well, you know, basically, how about me? I've endowed all these temples and built all these libraries. Surely I've acquired a lot of merit, a lot of good karma. And Bodhidharma said, really, you know, basically, you know, merit shmerit, you know. and so, you know, finally the emperor says something like, basically, he didn't really say merit shmerit, but the emperor said, but isn't this holiness? And he said, you know, we're not into holiness, we're into great emptiness. You know, great emptiness. And then the emperor it was like he didn't get it, right? So Bodhidharma, you know, basically the interview was over, the audience with the emperor was over, and Bodhidharma left and went up into the mountains. Basically, according to the story, after he was gone, the emperor said to another Buddhist monk, there were lots of Buddhist monks at the court of Wu of Liang, who was that guy? You know, who was that guy? But the monk heard the story and he said, that was the embodiment of the Bodhisattva of compassion, you know. And Emperor Wu said, oh no, what have I done? You know, and he said, let's call him back. And the guy just shook his head and said, you know, he'll never come back. Never come back. So he went up into the mountains and lived in a cave for 9 years and practiced Pi Kuan, staring at the wall of this cave. Pi Kuan is a metaphor, you could say, for what people do in Zen, which is to stare at the wall of Mu. And you know, he stayed there for 9 years and people started actually showing up. You know, people knew about him. Villagers would bring him food and things like that. And he would, they do this, this Indian monk was living in a cave meditating, and they honored him by bringing him supplies, you know. One day a person showed up, and who was his first student. And then another man, and then finally a woman. And those three people basically got Zen started in China. Those were his three students. So, you know, Bodhidharma brought Zen to China, and in Zen tradition, there's a famous question, you know, about why did he do this, right? Why did he do this? And, you know, you could say the answer is obvious, right? I mean, Bodhidharma left his home, probably in southern India. Some people think he was a Tamil, you know. So, you know, basically he left the Tamil Nadu and went to China in order to, you know, help people who are suffering. And he brought the Dharma with him. And indeed, you know, people were suffering. You know, there's all kinds of... In fact, you know, Emperor Wu of Liang was a really good guy. You know, it turns out in the Kelon, he's made out maybe not to be very bright because he doesn't get what Bodhidharma is saying, but actually he was an exemplary person. And he did really, you know, Emperor Wu's predecessor was worse than, as leaders go, worse than you know who. far, far worse. You know, he murdered people all the time, right? And he had orgies, right? No, seriously. I mean, he was like a bad guy, right? And he murdered people during his orgies, you know. So bad, right? And eventually he was so bad, he had like a crew of corrupt, murderous henchmen. But even they thought he was bad, and they finally killed him. And then Emperor Wu took over the kingdom. And he was like one of these miraculous situations, right? Like you know, every once in a while you get a president like Abraham Lincoln or FDR, Franklin Roosevelt. And you think, how did that happen? You know, honest, brilliant, you know, puts the people's welfare first, you know. So Emperor Wu of Liang was like that. You know, he was a great man, a great person. And he created a wonderful society. And he was so into Buddhism and into Zen that he would, well, he was, pardon me, not into Zen. He was so into Buddhism that he would go off to the temple for long periods. And all of his family and his courtiers, his bureaucratic assistants were terrified he was going to just abdicate and become a monk. So, you know, basically he would just say, you know, that's it, I'm going up to the monastery. And he'd spend like 6 weeks up there and he'd, you know, be raking gravel and reciting sutras and things like that. And, you know, finally they'd bring him back down. You know, so there was a lot of suffering in China before Wu, and actually there was a lot of suffering after Wu, because shortly after Bodhidharma and he didn't hit it off, Emperor Wu himself was there was a palace revolution. And he was captured by a member of his own family, a very opportunistic person who wanted to be the emperor. And he basically he knew it would be politically unpopular to kill Emperor Wu. So he put him in, he said he's going to spend more time with his family, as politicians say, right? So they put him in seclusion and starved him to death, basically. So lots of suffering, lots of bad behavior, and Bodhidharma came to India to help free people from their illusions. And it did make a huge impact, you know. Even though Zen did not have a very promising start, you know, a guy living in a cave for 9 years waiting for somebody to show up, you know, ultimately it became the major school of Chinese Buddhism. And it had a huge impact on the society, a very positive impact on the society. And so, you know, it worked in a very positive way, making China better. And just as Buddhism in India had this incredibly positive effect so it did in China. So you could say, well, it's obvious why Bodhidharma came from India to China. It's because he wanted to help suffering people and help them wake up. And it was urgent. He was urgently needed in China because, things were so screwed up and they needed some kind of insight into the reality of basic human loving kindness, basic human goodness. So that seems like an answer that would make sense, right? But it's not the one that these masters are willing to. They don't go down that road. It's just like when a monk asked Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? Joshu could have said, well, of course. All creatures have Buddha nature. Everything is, even the grass and the trees have Buddha nature. This is, why we don't, why we're vegetarians, blah, 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 But instead he just says moo. And this is actually very similar, right? Ryugi asked Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? See, and Suibi doesn't say, oh, China was so screwed up, they needed moral guidance, they needed insight into the reality. People get so bad, things get so bad that nobody believes humans are good. That happens all the time in history. Things get so bad that people become totally skeptical about the possibility of any kind of goodness, right? That really happens. And that's an incredibly corrosive situation. That's like, when you get to that level, this is going to date me, but if you've ever seen the movie The Godfather, that is like The Godfather. Everybody's killing everybody. You're always cutting a deal, right? So things can get really terrible, right? So, but Suibi doesn't say, oh, have you seen The Godfather? He doesn't say, oh, things were so terrible. Things were so terrible at the time of Emperor Wu. He says, oh, but pass me the chin rest, will you? And, we don't use it here. It wouldn't be permissible here, but in China and Zen at one time, people actually used a chin rest. So, monks would actually go to sleep on their mats. And if you have fallen asleep here in the Zendo, you know that when you're just about to doze off, you start leaning forward, right? And your forward motion probably wakes you up. Webb said that in Japan, during some of the special sessions they would have, they would sit all night. And he said, monks would actually... remember I mentioned that monks sat on a tan. They don't sit on the floor. So you're up on a little raised platform. And he said occasionally somebody would go tumbling over, as they lean forward, they don't wake up and they tumble onto the ground. And he said sometimes you'd see these monks with like scabs on their foreheads. So what they did to solve this problem was to invent a little chin rest. So you put your chin on it, and then it's like a little cane for your chin, right? And then you can fall asleep, and you won't go tumbling over and smash your head. You can just stay asleep all night. Okay, so Suibi says, by the way, pass me that chin rest, and then he hits him with it. And now the thing is, Ryugei is not an awakened person, right? He doesn't go, hey, what's going on? What are you doing that for? He understands what his friend and teacher means. He said, if you strike me, I will let you. But after all, there is no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming from the West. So just to make the point, we get the second installment of the same lesson, right? Then Ryugei goes to Linji, Rinzai, and he says, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? And Rinzai doesn't go, oh, things were so bad, blah, blah, blah. He says, pass me that cushion, will you? And Ryugei passed the cushion to Rinzai, who took it and hit Ryugei with it. And so if you're ever with a Zen teacher and the guy asks you to pass something, watch watch out. You know what's coming, right? And he probably does know what's coming, right? He probably does know it's coming. It's almost like it's almost like he's begging, you know, to get hit with the cushion, right? Anywhere you go in Zen and you ask that question, you know, you're going to get that answer, which is strange, right? Because, you know, Buddhism was so urgently needed in China as it is here in the United States, you know, so important, you know, so important. But you know, we don't get the speech about how important it is. And you can say, why not? Why are these guys so cavalier about something? But the thing is, you know, see, in a way, it's like if Joshu had answered the question to the monk, what, does the dog have Buddha nature, by saying, yes, all creatures have Buddha nature, he would be blinding the monk to the path to awakening. He would be guiding the monk in the wrong direction by getting him to use his discriminating intellect. Yet again, instead of discovering that we have this other mental faculty, you know, we have this, this other way of processing information on the cushion, entering deep samadhi, entering mu shin, and then mu itself is quite amazing, see. So, you know, he didn't lead the monk in the wrong direction. The same thing here. Right, so it is true that people are very screwed up and things can get very terrible. But actually, you know, by making a case for the importance of Buddhism, these masters would be untrue to what is most liberating about Buddhism. See? That there is no meaning to Bodhidharma's coming from the West. This is so, coming to the West, this is so important. If there were a meaning, it wouldn't be liberating. See, it wouldn't be liberating. If it had a purpose, it wouldn't be liberating. See, this is very hard for us to understand. Because, you know, we think of life as purpose, you know, purpose. So, you know, basically, you know, there was a book about 15 years ago, that sold like 20 million copies by a devotional author called The Purpose-Driven Life, you know. That, you know, you want to be driven by a purpose. And in the West, that seems so obvious, you know. To be driven by a purpose, you know, or higher purpose, you know. But actually, you know, from the Zen standpoint, there is no higher purpose. You know, the purpose is always just basically the same as like discriminating mind. Purpose is always a limited expression of our life. So, you know, I mean, when I was 12, my father enlisted me in the Boy Scouts, you know. And I didn't want to be a Boy Scout. I was an anti-Scout, you know. So Scouts are, you know, clean, brave, and reverent, you know. I was unclean, unreverent, and unbrave, right? And I basically wanted to sit in my room and read books. And my father wanted me to go out and do, you know, get merit badges. And, you know, I actually did get a uniform. And, you know, there's a uniform, you have a sash. And the sash is supposed to have all your merit badges. And you know, a lot of the guys in my scout troop, you know, had, you know, these sashes that were just covered. You know, there were these emblems on each merit badge has a little emblem. And this is like camping, and this is woodsmanship, just two like crossed hatchets, you know, and then there would be one for something, and one, you know, for first aid, there's a little first aid kit, you know, and you get all these things. It's wonderful, you know, kids learn all this stuff, you know, you learn how to, what happens if somebody breaks his leg, you can, You don't apply a tourniquet, you make a splint. You know, what if somebody's bitten by a snake? You know, you apply a tourniquet, you know, and what if somebody's heart stops and you learn how to pound their chest? You know, so it's all good, right? But I just couldn't get into it, right? Scouting for me just seemed, I was just not cut out to be a Boy Scout. I did discover one thing about scouting, though, that was amazing, and that was we went on a hike, a 50-mile hike, and we actually went on this long, arduous hike that was very poorly planned, and the scoutmaster had a 50-mile hike planned for 10-year-old boys, and we were all crying, but in the mountains outside of Washington, D.C., you know, my father grew up in Newark and New York City. He had never been out. He was like assistant scoutmaster. It was so ridiculous, you know. But we had our green uniforms on and so on, you know. But out there in the wilderness, you know, it was breathtaking. It's like nothing I had ever seen. You know, and it didn't make my commitment to scouting stronger. It made it clear that I would never be anything more than like a second class scout, you know, and that was my rank, second class scout. But because I wasn't really into these merit badges, but when I would get outside, when I would, you know, in my tent, I would come out of my tent and look up at the night sky, and it, far enough away from D.C. that you can actually see the stars, right? And you look up at the vastness that underlies us all, or that overcovers us all, and you just think, wow, you know, this is such it's so amazing to be alive. You know, I did feel like I wasn't cut out to be a Boy Scout. You know, the guys in my troop were all, I have to confess, I work out at a gym, and I know nothing. I have never had an interest in sports, you know. So I go to the gym and I hear people talking about, you know, this team and that team. Did you see the Cincinnati last night? Yeah. I have no idea, but I don't know. Some team in Cincinnati, sure. It was amazing, you know. Amazing. It was a wipeout, you know. So I try to fake it sometimes. And I do actually try to, there's a guy named Edwin who comes to the gym, and he's a baseball fanatic. And he'll say, do you remember the game in 74? You know, Sandy Koufax was pitching. And it's like, no, I forgot about that, you know. But these guys, my guys in my scout troop were like that, right? They were all, you know, so basically I just didn't belong there. And I was worried about it. You know, I was like, I don't fit in. I'm not fitting in here. You know, I'm not really, I don't really belong here. I don't have the same interests as these other kids. And I wasn't looking down on them at all. In fact, I thought of them as like, I was the abnormal one. What's wrong with me? You know, why don't I have any interest in sports? You know, and why, you know, they, at any rate, you know, I really was worried about it. But then when I started hiking with the scout troop, you know, it opened the door to me to this world where none of this matters. None of this matters. You know, it is important to know first aid, right? That's great. And I actually did learn how to actually, like, set a broken limb, you know, maybe, I don't know if it would work, but, you know, I learned, you know, certain skills, you know, and I did finally get the, the woodsmanship merit badge, you know, so I did have a couple of merit badges on my sash before I just bailed, you know, but, you know, the great discovery was that you could step outside of all this. And now it didn't really matter. And I don't think it was just an escape, you know. It didn't really matter if Craig Mosley had 40 merit badges and I had two. It doesn't matter, you know. And later, as an adult, I realized You know, it didn't really matter. Nobody, I don't know what happened to Craig Mosley. Maybe he's, you know, governor of Montana or something. But it doesn't matter. You know, the fact that he got 40 merit badges and I got 2 is really unimportant. And there's so many things in life that are like that. You know, in retrospect, we realize that was my purpose then. But after, now I realize I have a totally different purpose. You know, so my purpose as a Boy Scout was to acquire a lot of merit badges. And I did go through periods where I really worried about it. And, you know, it seems so absurd to me now. Why did I care about merit badges, you know? But, you know, one thing was that we had a paper drive. And, you know, people used to read something called newspapers. And they were made out of paper, believe it or not, you know. And you got them, they were delivered to your door, and you opened, you know, you read, they had, the pictures didn't move, you know, they were like printed on the paper, which is made from wood, right, you know. Very primitive technology. But at the end of a week or a month, people would have all this paper, and they didn't throw it in the trash, they stored it up so the Boy Scouts could collect it. And we would go around on the paper drive, and we had a big truck, and people would leave their paper out for us, and we'd put it in the truck, and it would be recycled. So it was our good deed for the day, right? Do a good deed for the day. And we were helping the environment. We could get an environment merit badge, you know. And I really took it seriously, you know. And I was out there, you know, on the weekend. I really wanted to collect that paper, and I would worry about it, right? And I would go home and talk to my mother, say, you know, we're just not getting enough paper. You know, what do we do? Oh, we have to get people going here, you know. And it was my purpose then, but you know, as you grow and change, your purpose keeps changing too. And you realize purposes are very limited. They're very situational, right? You know, you know, it's very important to be able to step out of the world of purpose and see the bigger picture. Realize that none of this is all of this is sort of artificial. It's artificial. You know, and being able to see that ends your suffering. It ends your suffering. You know, so, I mean, I've talked about this guy before. There's a guy in my department who has published like 6 books or something like that. And he's so famous in academic circles that, at the academic conferences, there are always different publishers. So there's like Harvard University Press, Princeton University Press. One press that puts his work out, they had a big sign out on their, you know, different publishers are at the conferences, and they each have a little booth, like a fair. It's a book fair. And each of the publishers has a booth, and they have their best authors out, and you can look at their authors. And they had a big, like a little banner, and it was, you know, mounted on fiberboard or something, and it said, "The novel, according to blah blah blah, my colleague." So he's so famous that he's like, he has the last word about the novel. He's like Mr. Novel. So if you read English, you know, if you say his name, people go, "Oh, the novel." You know, he's like, he's got it covered, right? And one time I was having lunch with him, and he just said, you know, there was somebody else. He was, he felt, you know, had beaten him. You know, had like beaten him. I've only got 6 books, you know, he's got 10, you know. And it's like, are you, you know, I felt like saying, are you crazy, you know? But, you know, it's like he couldn't step outside his purpose, you know. For him, you know, it was a competition with these other super geniuses to produce these books that nobody reads, right? And you know, he was behind in the race, you know. He'd only done 6, you know, and somebody else had done 8, you know. And people actually get like this, you know. Academics will get to, you know, they'll get an article in their field, and they won't even read the article. They go right to the end of the article to see if they're cited. It's like, well, I do work in that area. And who cares about the article? Am I in the footnotes, right? And if you're not in the footnotes, you get depressed. It's like, oh my God, I'm not in the footnotes. I'm forgotten. You know, my work, I'm over. I'm washed up, right? So this happens in every field, right? This happens in every field. people get so trapped in these ways of thinking. They get so trapped. You know, lots of people are, you know, like I, on the way here, I have to drive through basically part of Edison. And, you know, it's a neighborhood, a new neighborhood. And the houses are so big, you wouldn't believe it, right? They're giant, and they're all, they must be, multi-million dollar houses. I live in a part of Union County that's, the houses are really modest houses. They were built in the 1930s, you know. These houses are super, they're McMansions, right? But they're not cheap looking. They're really beautiful houses, and they're gigantic. You could put, they're bigger than this building, for sure. You could put five families in there, you know, basically. And, you know, it's all about competitive. It's competitive, right? People who buy those houses are like trying to signal that they've really arrived. And they're competitive, you know, in what they own and what they do. So they've got to, you know, if you don't have a, if you have to move from one of those McMansions down to a house like I live in, it would be like a major defeat and a total humiliation, right? Because, you know, that's how they think. They get caught in that. You know, if I'm a person of importance, I have to have a house of importance. You know, there was a guy who, an anthropologist, who did research on why Americans won't buy small cars. In fact, now again, you know, we're moving away from small cars. Americans are moving to bigger and bigger cars again. And Ford isn't even going to make small cars. They're just going to make trucks. And they're going to make giant trucks, right? It's so big you won't believe it, right? So you know, basically this anthropologist said, you know, basically many Americans see buying a small car as a failure. It's a symbol of failure because your car is small. You must be a small person. You know, you must not rate in the scheme of things. You know, you must be an unimportant person. If you have you know, unless you buy some, you know, little spider or something, which is a costs $800,000, you know, and so on. So this is like people get trapped in these ways of thinking, and then they lie awake at night and think, you know, they worry that they don't, you know, they haven't published their seventh book, or they worry that they don't have a big enough house, you know, or they worry that their car is a little, you know, their car is like 3 years old. What do their friends think? You know, I've got to get it traded in right away and get a new car. Or even when my brother was alive, he was very much into this world, you know, and he had to have a BMW, you know, I said, Peter, you don't need a BMW. He said, oh, you don't understand. You know, he was in business. He wanted to be able to drive up in a BMW. People would say, oh, that guy's successful. He has a BMW, you know. So you're under a lot of pressure. My brother didn't make himself like this. You know, the whole society made him, and he would lie awake and think, I've got to get a new BMW, you know, but he'd worry that his BMW was getting too old, you know. And I was just like incomprehensible to him because my car is like 18 years old. That's one step away from being like a hobo, a homeless person, you know. So my philosophy is to run them into the ground, right? Because they're just a car. I would say, Peter, they're just a car, you know. But they're not. They were a symbol, right? So anyway, you can get so trapped in all of this, right? This so trapped. And you know, liberation means being able to step out of all of this and see how artificial it is. It's a collective fantasy. You know, it doesn't matter if you have a big house. You know, it doesn't matter if you have a new car. You know, and there are many other things that don't matter. You know, when I was a failure as a Boy Scout, and I was worried that I was slipping behind in the merit badge race, you know. But, you know, when that hike, it was in the Appalachian Mountains in the Shenandoah National Park. I had never been out in the woods before, you know, and I just remember just looking at those stars and the smell, you know, the way a pine forest smells, and you know, the smell of smoke in the morning, crackling fire. It was like, wow, I love this. You know, I don't know why, but I feel so free. You know, and it didn't do any good for me. It didn't do any good. I actually did get the wilderness merit, or the woodsmanship merit badge. It's true. But, you know, other than that, you know, I kept hiking. I dropped out of the scouts, but I became an avid hiker. It's only cost me money to hike, right? I've never made any money. I can't put it on my CV. You know, really wouldn't help me looking for a job. Oh, I see you've got many hikes, you know, yes. But, you know, at the end of my life, I'm sure I'm going to say, you know, I'm so glad I did that, you know. It would make me feel so free. And I think Zen is like that on steroids, right? It's like stepping outside of everything that we're told is real and true. And looking up at those stars, you know, and cutting away, you realize, you know, I thought it happens to everybody, right? You know, you come to Sesshin and you're worried about this and you're worried about that, and then about day two of Sesshin, you think, you know, who cares? You know, I don't care. You know, I mean, there's definitely been people who have come to Sesshin who have been really, like, you know, there are people who have come to Sesshin, and this happened, you know, people who come to Sesshin who, you make a perfectly, really great livelihood, right? They have really nice salaries, they have good jobs, and they're crushed because they didn't get the raise they expected. And if you you can rationally say to the person, but, you know, are you hurting for, you know, are you worried about money? No. You know, do you have to sell your home? No. You know, so you did, okay, you know, so it's not the end of the world, but, you know, it can feel like the end of the world. Humans can create these artificial worlds that they seem so compelling and so real. And you know, being able to step out and look at the sky, and it's the vastness of the sky is so, it's worth everything. And people who can do that are more compassionate. You know, people are at their worst when they're feeling trapped by their way of thinking about the world. You know, you can see it when somebody's status is threatened, when their dignity is threatened, or when people can be nice, but when you can find that point where they feel everything is on the line. You know, it could be, it's different for different people, but you sometimes stumble upon it. You know, you suddenly hit that point where they feel that everything is riding on this, right? And at that moment, they stop being nice. You know, they can be like monsters. And you see that. You think, wow, where's that coming from? But somehow you've attacked somebody's basic identity or their basic way of thinking about the world, and they get vicious sometimes. And it's like a cornered animal. And they're not cornered. They're not animals. They just have forgotten who they really are, which is this beautiful, loving, kind, you know, basically the sutras say carefree. You know, when the Buddha got enlightened, this is very interesting. This goes back to the ancient or earliest Buddhist sutras. The Buddha is talking about how he went through all these stages of consciousness, and he finally reached a state of consciousness where he said, "There's neither, you couldn't even call it conscious or not conscious, right? The high, you know, you go through these stages of meditation. You get into deep samadhi, you go into mushin, you lose track of time, you lose track of your bodily sensations, and finally you're not even sure, am I dreaming, am I awake, and you're not even sure if you're conscious or unconscious." And then he said, you know, then he broke through. He had his Daikensho awakening. And after that, he said, you know, when he describes himself, he doesn't say, you know, I floated in the air, or, you know, he doesn't say, I was the greatest person of all time, you know, from that moment on, you know. He said, I was carefree. He said, carefree. You know, people don't necessarily think of enlightenment as producing a person who's carefree, but You can't be carefree if you're trapped in your value system. And when you, it's important to have a value system. It's important to be motivated, right? So I like to get a, I've gotten some raises. I like to get a raise. I put in for a raise. You know, if they apply for a raise, I apply for a raise. And if I get it, I'm happy. I'll go out to dinner. Let's go to a Thai restaurant tonight. It's fun. But, you know, if you don't get it, then you see, you know, how dangerous it can be to cling to this stuff too much. So, you know, it's okay to play these games to some degree. But it's like we're playing a game and then we take it too seriously. I don't know if when you were a kid, you know, you might have played. One thing I did play when I was in Baltimore was we used to play football. And it was just like, you know, you choose up sides and play football. It was touch football, right? And it's just a game. Nobody cares. But sometimes people would get so angry, they'd fight. It would turn into a fight. And it's like they're playing a game, but it becomes so real, the kids start hammering on each other. You know, real injuries, right? And it's like, step back. This is not it. This is a game. There are no consequences to winning in your backyard football game, right? It doesn't matter. And most of the things we do are kind of like that. Now, you know, if you're a surgeon, it does matter that you take out the right organ, right? You know, that would be important. But, you know, nevertheless, you know, if you put too much pressure on yourself, you're going to have trouble doing your best work. And if you can step outside of it all and say, you know, basically, there are many doctors and there are many surgeons in the world. There are many people as good as I am. You know, the real issue here is just helping the patient. It's not my identity on the line. I don't have to be the greatest surgeon of all times. I just have to help this person who's suffering. And if you can step outside of yourself a little bit, if your identity or who you are is not on the line, you know, I think you'd do a better job. You know, when I have to write, you know, I have to write something. The worst thing I can do is say I must write something truly great. You know, then forget it. It's going to be crap. You know, you've got to just say, I just have to write something, and we'll let the force move me. You know, we'll see where it goes. And some of it goes in the trash and some of it doesn't go in the trash. And sometimes you write something and you think, eh. And then you give it to somebody else and they say, oh, this is wonderful. And so, you know, being able to step outside of everything is so liberating. You can see everything with fresh eyes. You can see your own fear. You can see your own, the sources of your fear. And you can see the other person. When you're desperate, it's so hard to see the other person. It's so hard to be kind because you're fighting for your life. See, whenever you're in that sense, it's very bad to act from fear. And it's very bad, whenever you find yourself in that fighting for your life mode, stop yourself, because we all do that, but it's very bad. You know, it's coming from a place of you know, really real ignorance. That's real ignorance, you know. So anyway, this is why those Zen masters respond the way they did. You know, they said, don't get caught up in this stuff, you know. Look at the bigger picture. Enter Mushin and look at the stars. Ryuge asked Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? Suibi said, pass me the chin rest. Ryuge passed his chin rest to Suibi, who took it and hit him. Ryuge already knows. He's just having fun with his friends. He says, no, you can hit me, but there's no purpose to Buddhism. And by the way, if it had a purpose, it wouldn't be liberating. Ryuge asked Linji too, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? Rinzai said, pass me that cushion. Ryuge passed the cushion to Rinzai, who took it and hit Ryuge with it. Ryuge said, well, you can strike me if you want, but after all, there's no meaning to Bodhidharma's coming from the west. Secho's verse, Dragon Mountain. The dragon has no eye. Still waters don't impart the ancient way. If the board and cushion don't benefit you, hand them over to me. In other words, I'll hit them with you. Hit you with them myself. And then he adds, Secho says, I have not yet exhausted this, so here's another verse. Even if they are given to me, it's useless. Useless. So important. To be a useless person is so important. The useless is so important because it's outside of our artificial structures, right? Forests are useless, you know, just to go on just a little bit. You know, there are people who I was in the Virgin Islands once. This was 30 years ago, looking over the ocean, and there was nothing, just this beautiful hill, trees, and a guy drove up in a big Land Rover, a couple guys. They had drinks in their hand, and one guy said to the other guy, "What a shame!" He said, "A beautiful motel, you know, like no,
no.
What are you talking about? Are you, you know, a beautiful? We could make a big, you know, housing development right here. It's gone to waste, right? This has gone to waste. It's like, no, it's useless. Don't you see? That's why it's so wonderful. It's beyond our uses. It's beyond our uses." Another one, sorry. Many years ago, there was a fight over this sacred mountain out in Arizona. The government wanted to put an observatory on top of one of the mountains, right? Like a telescope. And it was a radio telescope, but the mountain was sacred to the Apache. And there was a big fight, and the Apache lost. But I watched it with great interest on TV, and the Apache chief gave a speech, and I agreed. He said, "These mountains weren't made for human foolishness." And it's like, yes, you understand, right? Even if they are given to me, it's useless. Not for me to sit like the ancestor. Beautiful. The evening clouds, endless, the distant hills, blue upon blue, peak upon peak.